More Idaho Matters right now from the studios of Boise State Public Radio News. I'm Gemma Gaudette. In 2015, the Soda Fire burned 280,000 acres of mostly sage-grouse habitat in southwest Idaho. Now, immediately after the wildfire was out, officials went to work trying to restore the landscape using thousands of pounds of seeds and herbicides, as well as millions of dollars, to keep out invasive plants and provide food and shelter to sage-grouse, pygmy rabbits, golden eagles, and other animals that live there. However, many scientists are finding that some landscapes can come back on their own, or with much less invasive help by people. And there are more and more examples of this kind of restoration popping up all around the West. Journalist Josephine Woolington did some digging into the idea of native restoration. In fact, she wrote the March feature story for High Country News about native plant species and restoring landscapes. And she's joining us live now to talk more. Welcome to the program, Josephine.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you traveled to several spots where this kind of native restoration is working, but I want to start, as I mentioned, with the Soda Fire. What did you find out about what happened after the fire was out?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the fall after the fire, the Bureau of Land Management began seeding pretty aggressively, both aerial seeding, so from a helicopter, and using a drill seeder, which is like a tractor attachment that kind of pokes seeds into the ground and creates actually a lot of soil disturbance, which some scientists, one local botanist, Roger Rosentreter, has argued actually invites more cheatgrass into the system. But also the BLM, you know, says that they were seeding with native seeds, but most of the native grass seeds that the BLM uses after wildfire are actually cultivars, so meaning they're plants that have been farmed or bred to grow maybe earlier in the season or grow taller and larger. And there's been, you know, debate about whether or not that's the best type of plant to put on the landscape or whether or not it's considered native.
So the BLM, as you mentioned, went to work right after the Soda Fire, and they spread herbicide and planting, and they planted plants. So how successful was this actual effort?
So the site that I went to, which was at about 4,200 feet, actually had more natural recovery than plants that came back from the seeding. So there was a lot of early sage that came back, which is a very low growing sage species that actually is the preferred food for most animals like sage grouse. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of wildflowers that came back naturally. And you know, there's it varies with elevation, but at that particular site, which, you know, the BLM was concerned would be taken over by cheatgrass, the natural recovery was actually quite stunning.
So there is a lot of talk these days about planting native plants on the landscape, but especially on the Soda Fire. And so as you said, I mean, really stunning, right, to find out how these plants came back. But you found that native plants used by officials aren't always native. So can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I found this part to be fairly surprising, because I think a lot of us with the plants that were being planted would have thought, oh, of course those are native to this area.
Right. So there are cultivars that are still used on the landscape after fire, like Siberian and crested wheatgrass. The BLM seeded small burnet and alfalfa over most of the burn, which is quite surprising. And of the plants that they said were native, like I mentioned, most of them were actually cultivars. So they're grown on farms, meaning that they have lost some of their wild traits. And so plants evolve in very particular locations, the precipitation level, the elevation level, the slope, all all affects how they are able to persist on the land. And when you take a plant out of that environment and start to grow them in a more controlled environment like a farm, that affects their genetics and how well they would be able to survive on the landscape.
And you found, if I'm correct, that there are a lot of, there are lots of kinds of sagebrush, right? Even native sagebrush, that we aren't even sure what was growing there before the fire hit.
Right. So the Oahes are relatively understudied when it comes to soil type, and soil type really determines what plants grow where. And again, it depends on elevation as well. But there are, you know, over two dozen types of sagebrush, and some of the more common types are the big sage. Most people, when they think of sage, probably imagine that type of the shrub. So Wyoming big sage was one botanist that I interviewed, as I mentioned earlier, Roger Rosentreter, at this particular site, said that it would have been a Wyoming big sage site and an early sage site. So, but the BLM seeded basin big sage there, as well as mountain big sage. And so it kind of was a mishmash of these sage species that aren't interchangeable. And they might grow for a few years, maybe even decades, because sage is pretty hardy. But long term, they might have a hard time persisting if they're not in the right place that they need to be growing.
So can we talk a little bit more in depth about native versus non-native? But I want to switch to scientists in that regard. So you talk to a lot of native scientists about the difference in techniques when it comes to restoring a landscape. So can you talk a little bit more about what you found? But first, I guess, let's talk about what we mean when we say native scientists. So people are, so we're all on the same page here.
Yeah, so I spoke with scientists who are indigenous, so native to or members of a particular tribe. So I spoke to scientists from the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, which is where I'm from in Portland, and the Yakima Nation, still a Guamish tribe in Northwest Washington. And so what I found talking with Native scientists is their perspectives on land management is quite different from non-Native scientists. They talk a lot about having relationships to a landscape, and relationships take time to cultivate. And those values of time and trust really played out in how they approached restoration. A lot of restoration can tend to be one size fits all, kind of go in and remove the invasives and then plant with native seeds. Or in the case of wildfires, go in and spray herbicide and seed with a bunch of plants and kind of expect, you know, plants to come back instantly. But for the native scientists, you know, they're thinking more long term. They think seven generations ahead. And so they acknowledge that these plants grow in stages and it takes a lot of time. And again, it takes a relationship to the landscape to get them kind of back on track.
And so is that really kind of what you found by talking to them is maybe just a broader understanding of, you know, native land, right? Native plants versus maybe a scientist who's coming in from somewhere else and maybe not, you know, may not be as familiar with these native plants.
Right. And there was one really interesting example from the Yakima Nation, which is in central Washington, where the Western scientists, so they were actually non-native scientists, but working for the tribe, had tribal elders take them out to this restoration site along the Toppenish Creek. And the elders told them stories of when they could canoe, you know, 20 miles upstream without portaging. And it was very confusing for the Western scientists to hear that because they just couldn't understand how that that may have been because the area was so flat and dry. But using that tribal knowledge helped inform their restoration, and they spent 15 years looking into, you know, how that creek and that floodplain must have functioned historically, and found that there would have been tons of beaver dams that raised the water levels to where, you know, generations ago people could have canoed all over the floodplain. And so tribes and indigenous scientists have a, you know, very deep place-based knowledge that is critical when looking to restore landscapes.
So you found that a lot of non-tribal projects actually operate on a really short timeline because they really want to restore the landscape right away. So there's this effort to do that. What did you find with that approach versus, you know, this approach you just talked about from Native scientists?
Yeah, so a lot of grants for restoration, so public grants, state grants, federal grants, they fund typically just 3 to 5 years of work. And 3 to 5 years is really, it's incredibly short on the time scale. For a landscape, you know, plants grow back in stages and, you know, might take at least a decade to for the landscape to mature enough to get to the point where it could, you know, be home to certain plants like sagebrush. Sagebrush is typically not the first plant to reappear after a disturbance. The BLM is operating on really short timeframes as well post-fire. They have, you know, just a couple weeks to decide what to do after a fire, meaning like what the restoration effort should be. So that doesn't give a lot of time for listening and observing on the landscape. And for scientists who are working with tribes, they tend to have more flexibility because they are able to go back to those properties and landscapes over time and observe and be able to adjust their restoration plans with a bit more flexibility than some of the federal grants or federal timelines allow for.
So I really like this phrase that you wrote about, letting the landscape talk to you. You heard this kind of advice at so many of the projects you traveled to. Can you talk a little bit more about that and how important is this idea?
Yeah, so that was told to me by a restoration ecologist who works for the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, just outside of Portland. And one site in particular that comes to mind is coastal sand dunes. So she wasn't referring to the sand dunes, but the Forest Service in Central Oregon has been removing European beech grass using bulldozers or herbicides. And once the beech grass is removed, native plants have been popping up, plants that haven't been seen on the landscape since, you know, colonization and since beech grass was planted there in the early 1900s. So these seeds are lying dormant underneath the sand or underneath the soil and just kind of waiting for these chances to regrow. And so I talked to a tribal leader at the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw tribe, and she comes from the perspective of, you know, if the plants are coming back, why not just work with them and see if they could repopulate, whereas the Forest Service is kind of approaching it as they're trying to figure out how to grow coastal plants and they want to seed because they don't trust that the plants could regenerate fast enough on their own. And so that was one of the more striking examples of, you know, a tribal perspective that is observing these plants coming back and kind of trusting that they can repopulate versus the non-native, more Western perspective that kind of has more of an urge to aggressively reseed and try to control the restoration.
So I have less than a minute left with you. So if you could quickly answer this question, do we just need to get out of the way and let these seeds sprout when they want to, and you know, restore a more wild landscape?
Yeah, I think it's a fine line. I think it's a lot of these projects, they weren't, sit back and wait. They were, actively digging out channels to allow seeds to come back and restructuring how the water flowed. So it's more of a maybe going into a restoration project with an open mind that maybe if you reconstruct how the landscape looked prior to colonization, that the plants could come back on their own.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today. Really fascinating conversation. So thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for your interest. I appreciate it.
Well, we've been speaking with journalist Josephine Woolington about the idea of native restoration. She wrote the March feature story for High Country News. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.